How's that coffee there, Bishop?
Yeah, pretty banging, mate. Yeah, I'm starting to got it just right now. You know what I mean?
Got the water nice. To bean ratio all right, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely spot on now, man.
Is it 3.5 lukewarm milliliters to one quarter bean times 10?
I'm a proper New Yorker now. I can gain respect from my peers, you know what I mean? Because I know how to make a good coffee.
And when you cross the street, you slam a fucking car bonnet and be like, I'm walking here.
Fuck, I'm walking here.
I'm fucking walking here. Goddamn coppers.
Well, should we crack on?
Let's change pure shit for like 15 minutes. Let's do it.
Welcome to a new episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. We have got a few things to get through on the football today. And then we have some feature fights, a review of the controversial Josh Taylor decision from last weekend, and looking ahead in the UFC to Masvidal versus Covington this coming weekend. But we're going to get through the Carabao Cup final review, Prem Roundup, and changes in management at Leeds. But we'll kick off the preamble ramble today with what's going on with Russia and their World Cup qualifying. FIFA initially came out and ordered them to play their upcoming matches without their flag anthem and as the Football Union of Russia in neutral territory. Now it looks as though they're going to be kicked out of the competitions altogether, both the national teams and club sides, UEFA and FIFA in staunch agreement. What do you think? I think, is this a harsh punishment, really? Because, you know, the Russian sports teams, based on, you know, what are essentially the rash decisions like of Putin, and even his own chief of staff doesn't want smoke. Like, where do we stand? Is this fair on the competitors?
I don't know. I don't think it is that fair on the competitors. Though it would have been difficult to sort any matches out, because I think initially they were supposed to have a World Cup qualifier with Poland, but Poland were just flat out refusing to play them. And it seems likely that other teams would refuse to face them, you know, as well. Also, Russian teams wouldn't really be able to go anywhere in Europe. And it looks like this is not without precedent. Back in the 90s, Yugoslavia and Serbia had the same reactions from FIFA and UEFA. And I think we were talking about in the 50th special episode about Denmark winning the Euros in 92. That led to them qualifying, apparently. They took Yugoslavia's spot after they were banned, having, you know, not originally qualified to the tournament. So, I don't know. I don't think it is very fair to the competitors, but I can't see a logical way for them to allow them to keep playing. I don't think anyone's going to want to play them. Also, just to chuck something back at you guys, who do you think would take Russia's place in these qualifiers now?
Fucking Russia, they're like one of those teams that are like, okay, they're like, get to the tournament. Even when they're at home, I think they won in the 2018 World Cup. I think they won their first game 4-1, then went on a mad slide. They're like an average team, basically. But the overall question, is it fair on Russian athletes? It's a bit slack, isn't it, man? I mean, they're like, we're going to talk about it later on with the boxing, but for all sports people, you spend your whole life working towards something, especially in like a Soviet-esque system where it's proper harsh. We've seen it in the ice skating the other week with that young girl. It's like, should the sanctions of war extend to athletes? I'm not quite so sure, man. Could they have not just done like a middle ground thing like they do at the Olympics? It's the Russian Olympic Committee, isn't it? They still allow them to compete. I'm sure they could have found some middle ground, but the environment, the current climate is such that people just aren't on it. Like you say, teams, other countries, other institutions are just like, nah, fuck these, like, until they sort it out. So, yeah, I think it's harsh on the athletes, but it's just one of the unfortunate, probably one of the less serious consequences of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine.
I think certain sports organisations have taken different stances. I think the FIA, they've allowed their Formula One, or there's a Russian Formula One driver that's going to compete under a different banner. Obviously, Spartak Moscow have been eliminated from the Europa League. So Red Bull, I think Leipzig, they're the beneficiary of that. They're going to go straight through to the next round. I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen with the World Cup qualifying, whether Russia just get eliminated. What happens with their points totals? Because it's halfway through, isn't it? I think, is there a couple games left? I think a World Cup qualifying, and then obviously you'd have the playoffs to see who'd qualify. You know, it's all up in the air, really, isn't it? But I think on the general scheme of things, like, you know, is it fair? I'd agree with both of you. I think we're all in agreement with that, is that it's not really fair on the competitors. I don't think that this sort of thing should seep into the players' lives and, you know, teams' lives.
But again, it's a good thing that people are standing in solidarity with the Ukrainian people, mate. It's a fuck one, you know. I've intentionally stayed away from the coverage because I don't want to get like entertainment kicks of something so horrific. I watched like the UN stuff, like you alluded to, Putin's chief of staff was like, we basically, after some ominarium, say we support the notion to recognize Ukraine's sovereignty. And Putin was just like smiling, like, yeah, I'm going to fucking kill you, mate. Do you know what I mean? He's on one, isn't he? Like, he's definitely a committed man, whether it's right or wrong. And it might be a double standard for other Western countries to deplore that or make him out as the bad guy. But it's something all of our countries have done. So it's just fucking horrible for the people involved, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And we, you know, join everybody else in the solidarity with Ukraine. And hopefully it comes to a peaceful resolution sooner or later, innit? So we can get back to, you know, sports being the main headline of news rather than war. So we'll move on to the football talk. Carabao Cup final. I'm not sure how much of this you managed to catch, but it was probably one of the most entertaining nil-nils you're ever likely to see, to be honest. There was VAR controversy again. And another case of a manager overthinking tactically. So we'll go over that in a little bit. But did you catch any of this or did you catch the highlights?
Caught the highlights. I saw that Lukaku had a tight angle near side shot kind of deflected away from the keeper. I seen the VAR controversy where he swept home quite nicely. Don't think that was offside myself. I saw Chelsea's keeper Mendy pulling off absolute heroics throughout the game. A double save from Sadio Mane stands out in particular. I think Thiago Silva also had a good game. I think Salah got through on Mendy, chipped him. Not sure if the ball was going wide or not, but Thiago Silva managed to cover the ground and get back. All in all, looked like a very, very entertaining game. And I couldn't believe it when I seen the penalty totals. Was it like 11-10, 12-11 or something like that?
Yeah, and the funniest thing about it was we spoke about Pep in the Champions League final and about how he may have overthought it tactically by leaving out Fernandinho, I think it was at the time, who was you know, in good form and obviously, you know, very, very good in that position. And in this case, it was Tuchel who was on the other side of that tactical overthinking in the Champions League final. But this time, he'd obviously come up with this scenario prior to the game, and it was bringing Kepa on as a penalty saving specialist for the shootout. And interestingly, and a huge sense of irony with this is because Kepa was the goalkeeper that refused to come off in this very cup final 3 years ago for Willy Caballero. So if you remember, it was Sarri, wasn't it? Sarri that was charge at the time. And, you know, he's a coach that perhaps didn't have or hasn't got the same amount of respect as the two coaches that were involved this time round. But anyway, he was a young goalkeeper. He still is a young goalkeeper, but 3 years, I think he was about 21 years old, refused to come off, you know, winked at the camera prior to the penalty shootouts, ended up being on the losing side of the shootout that time. And once again, he was on the losing side of it. And I think the blame has to be at the foot of Tuchel. You know what I mean? Because I thought Mendy was having a fantastic game. I think arguably the man of the match. I'm not sure who did receive that credit in the end, but he was having a great game. Very experienced goalkeeper. I think he's been absolutely class since he's joined Chelsea. And to take him off in that situation, for me, it does feel like, why do you need to do it? Obviously, they've agreed it prior to the game. They've said, right, Kepa, you're doing well in training. You know, we're going to go by. And then once again, it feels like a data decision. Do you know what I mean? Oh, you're the best man for the job when it comes to penalty shootouts. So we're going to make that decision no matter what. But once again, I do feel that there's something. That gut instinct is there for something. Do you know what I mean? I do think that sometimes you just use your head. He's having a good game. You don't want to bring a player on that's completely raw, you know, not warmed up at all. I think the first time he touched the ball was from a goal kick. And the next thing you know, I don't think he touched the ball with his hands almost throughout the whole penalty shootout, really. You know, not any meaningful touch of the ball anyway. So his first touch of the ball with his feet was missing a penalty. So he's gone through that whole scenario. 11 penalties that he didn't really get near even the one where he stood to, you know, far right of the goal, almost closer to the post than he was to the middle of the goal for Van Dijk's. And Van Dijk's put it the same side and he still didn't get near it. So I don't know what he's been working on, if he's a penalty, you know, penalty saving specialist, but it was a gamble that really didn't pay off for Tuchel.
Well, he's a baker by trade, isn't he? So you can understand. No, but there are echoes of England's final against Italy here with Rashford and Jadon Sancho coming on last thing. We all question that may be different for outfield players. If you're a penalty specialist, maybe you can adapt a little bit quicker to a penalty shootout situation. But you've got to give Mendy the respect that he earned, not just throughout the game, but throughout his tenure at Chelsea so far. You've seen the game he's having. He's going to be firing. You know, if I was going to put money on it, I would say he's far more likely to react quicker and to be reading the players' faces and their gesticulations and their attitudes in terms of the penalty shootout. It's a big mind game, isn't it? A penalty shootout. So, yeah, sounds like Tuchel made a huge misstep. And, you know, the Carabao Cup, you might think that's the smallest cup. Right? It doesn't matter. You can go on, you can do other things. But it's these things matter in the course of a season. You know, if Liverpool lost that, maybe that could have dented their confidence for the title race. You know, Chelsea aren't going to be feeling great after this. They're going to progress in Europe. It might affect them in a whole heap of different ways. So, yeah, a cup's a cup for Liverpool and the first of a potential four. Imagine if they win the quadruple after we're slagging them off.
I've got a question about them bringing on Kepa. So it looks like the decision was made because he's saved more penalties than any other goalkeeper in Chelsea's history. But that's only 7 he saved in total out of about 24. So it's about 1 in every 3. Do you reckon that's a good enough reason to bring him on last minute for a cup final penalty shootout?
Huge numbers, mate.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. You fancy a goalkeeper like Mendy as well. He was making some fantastic stops throughout the whole game. Like, you'd put your money on it. He looked well up for it, so I don't understand him taking him off. But, you know, Mason Mount missed chances. You see the chances he missed? Huge, huge chances. And I think...
Hit the post, didn't he?
Yeah, hit the post in the second half. And I think he had one just at the end of the first half that he should have done better with. Obviously, Lukaku's offside decision, I still don't understand it. I've looked at it 2 or 3 times since. You know, it doesn't look offside. Like, first and foremost, it just doesn't look offside. And then secondly, they're saying that, you know, his shoulder. So they say it's handball from, I think, the point, or they used to say the point of where the T-shirt would start. So it's somewhere sort of between the elbow and the shoulder. That's where the sort of handball line starts. So that's the line they use for the offside, because apparently you're going to score a goal with, like, your shoulder in it. How likely is that? But I don't know. I feel like there should be a rule that gets introduced where, I don't know, if the goal that you ended up scoring was with your feet, then surely the offside line should be from where your feet were when the pass was made. If you score with your head, then the offline should be where from where your head was, because there's a big difference, man. There's, like, you know, how many feet difference when you're leaning at an angle to where your feet would be and where your head would be.
Aren't you allowed to score with your shoulder?
Yeah, you are allowed to, but how many people score a goal with their shoulder?
No, I'm just saying that's a strange boundary to set if you're allowed to score with your shoulder. And also, they have long sleeve tops as well. So it's just silliness, isn't it? What's the point in having the technology, all the technology at their disposal, and they can still get something like that wrong? You should, like... I don't know, man. It's just fucking ridiculous. They may as well not have it. It was better when the only certain thing was that you knew when the ball crossed the line. That it was better when it was like that. And then you could just... Because now, they don't even see every replay. What's the point in having VAR if you don't show the referees every replay? It's a fucking redundant system. And it's only been enacted like 4 years ago or something. 3-4 years ago. Probably not even that.
Would it make more sense if... Because I think VAR seems like it should work. Would you be more on side with it if refs got to see all these different angles?
But they do. You know, they get allowed to go over to a pitch side monitor where apparently that's meant to give him clarity on the decision, or he's going to clear everything up. But the problem with VAR is, even though you have these different camera angles and you get a replay of the incident, like, there's still a level of objectivity to it. So it's very, very difficult. With the VAR offside calls, it's meant to be clear-cut, but it still ain't. Like, that one just wasn't clear-cut.
The Rangers won the other week. They were saying on the commentary, I don't know if this is true, but they're saying that here's an angle that the referee didn't see for that goal that was disallowed for Rangers. They were saying he hasn't been shown this angle. How is that possible? Look how many cameras, look how many camera operators are in. It's not hard to put that together. They've got a team of like media specialists on it to get that highlight package together. Quick time, man. Anytime the ball goes out of play, they'll show you several replays, quick time. Like, how can they not show that to the officials? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
The only argument would be that they're trying to, you know, expedite the process as much as possible. Do you know what I mean? They want it to happen in, you know, under 2 minutes flat, because the longer it takes, you know, eyes start turning off tellies, don't they? So I don't know, man. I just feel like they really, really need to once again revisit it, and they need to refine the rules, especially when it comes to the offside call. But I saw an interesting opinion in the Twitterverse. This is to do with the penalties. They reckon that if a team gets through all 11 players without a miss, that the manager should take the 12th penalty. What do you reckon about this one, Flynn?
I think that's amazing. I think that should have been the rule all along. But I was just looking into it. I wanted to see if there were many other cup finals where more penalties were taken. And there was back in 2005, in the final of the Namibian Cup, we saw an astonishing 48 penalty kicks taken.
All of them misses.
It was a score of 17-60. All of them misses.
There's a lot of misses in there, though. There was 48 penalties. That's 20, you know, 24 each team.
There's a
good six or seven misses in there. That must have been a pretty brutal penalty shootout to watch.
I'll have to go tell the misses, mate. Absolutely ridiculous. There is also an under-21 game between England and, I think, Netherlands. In the final of the under-21 European Championships, I think that about 12 or 13 each.
Unfortunately, no managers were taking them there.
Oh, yeah. Only if they have to wear their shoes while they take it.
Yeah, full suit, like still suit. Yeah,
definitely.
Not allowed to change into boots, are they? Do you know what I mean? So you've got to be very selective about your footwear going into the final. Do you know what I mean? That's it. You're not allowed to bring in new equipment, man. But another couple of things, Luis Diaz, who's Liverpool's new signing, he looked a threat, man. I think he looks like he's going to be a very, very good player. Very direct, very confident on the ball, just wants to beat a player one-on-one. So I think he gives a different dimension to sort of like Salah, Firmino, you know, all the sort of players he got there. He's just very, very direct. So he's looking like he should be a really good sign for Liverpool yet again. They don't seem to get many things wrong when it comes to signing players. And obviously, you know, that penalty, like Kepa, I know he's a goalkeeper, but did you actually see the penalty? What was he trying to do, man? He looks like he's tried to, I don't know, he's leaning back. He's just hit it as hard as he can. Oh, I don't know, it's painful for me.
It's like what's his name? Was it Psycho? Stuart Pearce in 1990. Just so intent on levering the ball that it ended up in the fucking car park. Like, absolute desires up in smoke, desires and dreams. Yeah, it's almost as if he's a goalkeeper. We still believe. Can't wait for the next one, man. It's going to be sweet. Yeah, like, it's almost as if he was a goalkeeper taking that penalty kick, isn't it? It's almost as if he hadn't been practicing that technique.
Yeah, but elite-level goalkeepers should be able to get a penalty on target. And, you know, obviously there's the added pressure, but I still think, like, a goalkeeper... Like, look at the centre-back's penalties, man. Like, Van Dijk's penalty was class. I think Joel Matip, his penalty was quality as well. Thiago Silva, who had a great game as well, I think still is one of the best centre-backs in the world. His penalty was class. Like, to be honest, everybody's penalty is good. Even Kelleher, the Liverpool goalkeeper, 21 years old, man. Like, who would have expected him to, like, come out there and, you know, he'd done really well throughout the whole game. And then he calmly slotted away the penalty against the penalty-saving specialist. So,
what was the thing about Minamino? They like Jordan Hendo and the boys were like taking the cup, the trophy towards Minamino. Did he not play or was he injured or something like that? Did you not see that?
I know Thiago Alcantara, is it? The one that's came from Bayern. He got injured in the warm-up. So was it that or I don't know? I'm not sure.
I just seen it flash past. I just seen him giving it loads, like trying to give Minamino credit. I thought he might know, but yeah, whatever. Minor point.
Yeah, we'll move on to the Leeds situation. And we was talking about this last week and we knew it was pretty much inevitable. But Bielsa has been sacked as Leeds manager after, I think, about 3.5 season three and a half seasons in charge. They brought in Jesse March, who's another player we briefly spoke about last week. He'll become the second American coach since Bob Bradley spent, I think, 11 games in charge at Swansea. You know, a fairly ignominious performance, really, for him. Jesse March, his career, you know, it's nothing. He didn't play in Europe. He spent his whole career playing in the US. Had 200 appearances for Chicago Fire and 106 appearances for Chivas, who don't exist anymore. and his first gig, as a coach, was a United States assistant coach, and then he coached Montreal Impact, got involved in the Red Bull setup, coached Red Bulls for 3 years, was relatively successful there, and then he coached Red Bull Salzburg and was very, very successful there. And I think that's what's paved the way for his opportunities that he's had, you know, since last year, really, because I think he won with Salzburg, he won the Bundesliga, the Austrian Bundesliga and the Austrian Cup a couple of times, I think. He was there for about 3 years. And then he got his opportunity at Red Bull Leipzig. And that really didn't work out for him. He didn't really have a terrible record. I think I've got it up here. He won eight games out of 21. 38% win percentage. Probably not good enough for Red Bull Leipzig, but looks like he was let go, or they mutually agreed to terminate his contract based on, you know, philosophical reasons, footballing reasons, which leads me to believe that, you know, the whole Red Bull thing, does that really make sense then? If they didn't agree philosophically, why did they hire him? But he's going to go into Leeds, you know, and he's going to come with a lot of baggage, really, in terms of like the way American coaches are perceived in the Premier League. We know that Bob Bradley, like, he got absolutely ripped on, like Brad Bobley, who was being called by the media and that. And then like Chris Armas, obviously he's come in as assistant coach, obviously got a history with Red Bulls as well. So it's paving the way for American coaches. But, you know, my question to you two is, do you think this guy is going to get any respect, you know, initially, and how hard will he have to work and how well will he have to do with Leeds before he does get any respect?
He's got a bit of an uphill battle getting accepted. I'm just reading up on Bob Bradley, and have you heard some of his quotes that people used to rip it on? He used to talk about scoop de loop volleys, meg nuts, and midfield stripes. And he once called, in a press conference, he once referred to penalty kick as a PK.
That is what all Americans refer to penalty kicks as. They call them PKs, isn't it?
Move on, right. Move home, Bissett.
They call midfielders middies. They called wide midfielders outside middies. What else do they say? I think they call, what do they call free kicks?
Don't know. They can suck on these meg nuts, though. Unreal.
Yeah, meg nuts. I think Soccer AM used to rip on it, like absolutely rip on him, man. So, you know, as you say, uphill battle. And it's, you know, hard enough coming into a team that's conceded the most goals in February in history in the Premier League. And I think only beaten by Newcastle. I think it was in the 80s. And they conceded 21. So, you know, he's got to sort the defence out. And the issue I've got with it, and I think it's quite brave, from the Leeds board, obviously Andrea Rezzani, he's, you know, made a sort of a brave decision by bringing in Jesse March, because I would say he's from the same sort of ilk as Marcelo Bielsa. He's going to come in and I think he's going to have really strict training regimes. He's going to expect the players to work very, very hard. So he's got a very designed philosophy when it comes to how he wants teams to play. He wants there to be high intensity. I think when he was coaching at Red Bulls, Bradley Wright Phillips was saying that he thought he was fit and he came in to play for the Red Bulls. And like, he was like dying from the amount of intensity that that was expected from the team in his training sessions, which leads me to believe is these Leeds players, I don't know, do they need somebody to come in and say like, look, we're just going to play pragmatic football. We're going to get 11 bodies behind the ball when we haven't got it. We're going to look to frustrate the opposition. We're going to stay nice and compact. And then we're going to try and hit teams on the counter-attack rather than another coach coming in and say, look, it's balls to the wall again, lads. You're just going to have to, you know, bomb it everywhere, hunt impacts, make sure that you sprint into every ball. So, you know, I feel like it's a brave decision, and I do commend like the Leeds board for thinking that this is the right appointment. It feels like a gamble, but for me, I personally don't see it going well. What do you reckon?
What if he comes in and he finds a squad full of players that are just fucked from Bielsa's methods, and he takes that to mean that they're unfit, and then he ups the fucking fitness regime, which is going to lead to more injuries, more problems, you know? But also, it could come in, honeymoon period vibes. The players could get a mental lift just from having a change at the helm. Then they might scrap like 1-1 here, 2-0 there. Then all of a sudden, they're on the road again at there. So this could work out in a variety of ways. But I'm just impressed that they managed to hire a man with the most American-sounding name I've ever heard. Brother of Randy Marsh from South Park. That's what I heard, mate. He's going to be in the stands when Leeds are playing, punching up lads in the face, trying to be a man because a man's got to learn to take it. Do you know what I mean? He's going to be killing it. Strong woman.
So
strong woman.
Can you not see this paying off at all? Like, say how we talked about last week about teams that spend a lot of their time in relegation battles and keep bouncing back up. Can you not at all see anything like that happening?
What, if they do get relegated, you mean?
No. If he comes in and fixes everything and saves them, because they're kind of being threatened. They're being threatened with relegation at the moment, Leeds, no?
Absolutely. Based on their, you know, recent form, you'd have to assume. They're not quite down there yet. I think they may be about 3 or 4 points off the relegation places. But in terms of their, like, nosediving form, you'd have to say they're a relegation candidate, if not one of the favourites, to be honest. And, you know, even the news reports, like, you know, so far, Jesse Marsh faces tactical challenge. Like, the linguistics are pointing towards negativity already, cultural shock. They're talking about must fight US stereotypes as well as relegation at Leeds. So they feel like, you know, even that article headline suggesting that facing the US stereotypes is going to be just as hard as saving a team from relegation in the Premier League. So he's really got like a lot of things on his hands. I hope that he does well because I think he comes across really well. I think he knows the game intimately. I like his philosophy. I like the way he wants to play. So I'm hoping that it turns out well for him because I think, you know, it's about time we have an American coach that does something well over here, do you know what I mean? And has success. Obviously, Bruce Arena is one of the biggest coaches in sort of American soccer over here in terms of his achievements, both in the college game and in the MLS. And he's never got his opportunity. He had the opportunity with the US national team, like completely fucked that up, but he never got an opportunity to coach over in the Premier League. Bob Bradley did, but I think his personality is like very, 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 very different to Jesse Marsh's. I think he's going to go down a lot better, Jesse Marsh. So I think he's got the advantage there. Because if you look at any sort of pictures of Bob Bradley, like him not really being respected or taken seriously on the sidelines. Yeah.
But you know what, man? The thing is, you're reading that article. Everyone's going to read articles of a similar tone. It's like the media's creating that perception. Like, I don't necessarily think an American can't do it or whatever. I just think, oh, there's an American coach there. But as soon as you read a headline like that and read, oh, the battle's on and off the pitch for Jesse Marsh, Korean Priish. Do you know what I mean? As soon as you start going down them lines, people are automatically, they're going to be repeating that tomorrow at work. I guarantee you, man, if they give a shit about Leeds. You hear people parrot headlines and what they say in the studios and all that. So it's a big of a deal as Jesse Marsh allows it to be in the dressing room and in his own head. And if he can cut all that off, then his coaching will do the talking for him.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that, as you say, he will get questions posed at him in post-match and pre-match interviews and anything surrounding his job, really. He's probably going to get the links to Ted Lasso. Like, that's just going to happen. And, you know, it is the media that create this sort of fantasy that American coaches can't be as good as coaches from the rest of the world. And it is a fallacy because, he could come in and do a great job. He's obviously well-respected. He wouldn't have got his chance at Red Bull Leipzig otherwise. And that makes it the second time now he's come in after Bielsa. It makes it the second time he's come in after a well-respected manager has left the club. Because obviously it was... What's his name now? That was at Red Bull Leipzig. Julian Nagelsmann, who left that position. Another really well-regarded coach, one of the brightest young coaches in world football, and then Marcel Bielsa with all the respect he's got from his peers. So it's going to be interesting. But I hope for Leeds that they can stay up, and hope he can do a good job. We'll go over the Prem roundup. So Man City beat Everton 1-0. That was a very, very contentious VAR decision that we'll talk about in a sec. Manchester United and Watford, bore draw. Hodgson bounces back after losing, I think, was it 4-1 to Crystal Palace last week? Crystal Palace, Burnley, they had a 1-1 draw. Villa bounced back after their defeat to Watford. They won 2-0. Newcastle United beat Brentford 2-0. Brentford, they seem to be a team. We spoke about them last week. They're not in any kind of form at the minute. They're looking really, really bad, because Burnley have picked up a few results recently. Newcastle are top of the form table over the last few games. And obviously Southampton as well. They picked up another win. So, you know, there's teams that you wouldn't really expect at this stage of the season are picking up wins and looking good on the form table. And obviously Spurs with that 4-0 defeat that condemned Bielsa to leaving his position as manager. So what do we think? Who's it? West Ham obviously won 1-0 as well, beat Wolves. Who are the teams in the ascendancy, and who are the teams that are, you know, looking like they're going to really be struggling?
Well, Newcastle, obviously, they're turning things around in a big way. Even though Trippier is missing as well, so fair play to them. Apparently, I read something from Trippier the other day. He said Joe Linton is the best geezer on the training field. Something like a lot of people would find unbelievable. I couldn't say one way or the other, but I remember you slating the life out of him a couple of months ago. And he was saying that since Eddie Howe's come in, they've seen a different player altogether. So that's good signs for Newcastle. I was also shocked to learn that Leicester's 1-0 win over Burnley on Tuesday was their first win in the league since December. That is fucking mental. Do you know what I mean? They're always considered a really good team, like top six, top seven, at least since they won the Premier League. A stat like that is pretty damning, man. And it was nice play. Goal from Vardy, goal from Madison, two of their top boys. But come on, fucking hell. They're better than that, aren't they? Do you know? And think about it as well. Vardy's like 34, 35. They're going to have to fill that substantial hole pretty soon. So I don't know what the future holds for Leicester in the grand scheme of things. Obviously, they'll be all right in the league, but this year at least. But, you know, up ahead, it could be a bit ropey for them.
It's interesting you mentioned Joe Linton, because his first season, I think he cost like 40 million or, you know, something along those lines. A very, very high-profile signing for Newcastle. And he only managed scoring, I think, two goals in 38 appearances, got up here. And then he only managed four goals the season after in 31 appearances. But I think that Eddie Howe has transformed him into sort of like a midfielder now. Because he was sort of like an out-and-out striker when he first came. And, you know, he was at the centre of a lot of criticism from Newcastle fans. But he seems to have been like transformed by Eddie Howe into a sort of box-to-box midfielder, which is baffling, like, to be honest, really, because you don't really see that at the elite level, do you? You like hear about sort of, you know, back in the day, like Alan Shearer playing in goal. I think it was David De Gea that played in goal as when they, you know, turned into a centre forward. Dion Dublin used to play centre back and centre forward sometimes. Do you know what I mean? So there are players that have like transferred positions, but you don't really hear about it in the modern era, and especially at the highest level.
Who's your man from West Ham, the right back who plays striker now?
Mikel Antonio, yeah.
Yeah, he's another example, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose you could say Gundogan, but that's kind of like a little shift sideways, not really an out-and-out change of position. You could argue Kane occupies a little bit of a more central position on the field. Rooney certainly dropped a bit deeper later in his career, but still not as... I don't know. I suppose if a manager comes in and he sees things a little bit differently, he doesn't put people in boxes like, you're a striker, you're a midfielder, and he's willing to assess them based on their attributes and where that would best work on the field, you're more likely to see changes. But if a manager's rigid in his perceptions and he's just got like, say, 10 defenders, 10 midfielders, 8 strikers or whatever, then you're going to get a more static operation, which isn't the most useful thing in the modern game.
I think that shows, that's credit to Eddie Howe and the job he's doing there, really, isn't it? I always forget, I checked it earlier, Obviously, we know him about his time at Bournemouth. I think he had two spells there. He started off coaching there at a very young age because I think his career finished early. And then he went to Burnley, which I don't remember at all, but he spent a year at Burnley. I don't think he was very successful there. And then he had that 8-year stint at Bournemouth, was one of the longest reigning managers in the Premier League, if not the longest reigning manager when he left, perhaps. I think, you know, Sean Dyche, I think he's been with Burnley now for a rough amount of time. He might have been the guy that succeeded him at Burnley, perhaps. And obviously he did a really good job at Bournemouth. You know, I think they got relegated during that stint and he got them back up, if I'm not mistaken. And then now he's doing a really good job at Newcastle. It took him a while, you know, to get into the swing of things, but top of the form table. I think they didn't have one single victory when he came in after, was it 14 games, I remember saying. And then, you know, they've already won, what, 4 games under his tenure so far. So, you know, I think potential England manager for the future, do you reckon?
Oh, you love it, didn't you? It's been a while since you mentioned England, is it? It's been a long while, man. Are you already sharpening that kitchen knife for between Gareth Southgate's shoulder blades, or are we going to give him one more talk? Yeah. After like the greatest success since 1966, you're just being him off for Eddie Howe, who's on a 4 or 5 game winning streak with Newcastle. Go on, visit. I love it. You hate the man, you love England. Fair play.
Let's talk about this Man City VAR call then, the penalty decision. If you haven't seen it, let's quickly grab it up. I'm going to have a little look at it again. Yeah, and obviously this decision happened after they went 1-0 up. I think a through ball has been put through by somebody on the Everton left side. I think it was through to Richarlison. He's ran onto it. And the goalkeeper's rushed out. Edison's rushed out. It's sort of cannoned off Edison. And then is it Rodri? Rodri's gone to control the ball. And it's obviously got a lot of spin on it from that sort of that ricochet with the goalkeeper. And it's sort of bounced up. And it's clearly hit like that portion of the arm. So from, you know, we was on about earlier, that area from the sort of elbow to the shot to the shoulder.
It's hit his bicep, isn't it? Clearly.
Clearly hit his bicep, and surely that has to be part of the area, the realm in which it's considered handball. But apparently, the reason that it wasn't given was because it was not handball. There was people saying that it might have been down to the fact that Richarlison was offside when the ball was played through, so it kind of makes the phase of play obsolete anyway because he was offside. But nah, apparently it was down to the fact that it was just handball. The referee didn't deem it as being handball. Oh, I'm not so sure about that.
Did you see the replay?
Exactly. Did he go and watch it? Yeah. He went to pitch side and he looked at the video evidence and he still didn't make the decision that it was handball.
Oh, come on. What's the fucking point? What is the point in VAR if you're going to make that decision? What's a handball? Shoulder down, roughly. It hit him there. In front of everyone? Oh, come on, forget it.
Is that what they say? Anywhere from the shoulder down to handball?
I don't know. The rules change on it so often, but I'm pretty sure that it's that sort of like T-shirt level down to the hand. That's considered handball, I believe.
Right. I'm going to try and look this up, see if we can find out.
Get Flynn on it. Come on, where's the rules? But when are we going to change to a crowd, I don't know, a panel of like experts? So let's say everybody in the room has like let's say we've got 20 ex referees in like watching the game, and like they go to like you know, it's like ask the audience, like in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So it's going to be like ask the ex referees, and they all have like a yes or no, is it a penalty? They all, you know, and if it's over 50%, whichever way it is, obviously it could be 10 versus 10. You're going to need 21 people in there. So if it's over 50%, it's a penalty. When are we going to do something like that? I mean, I would rather that than one man making a decision based on video evidence that he's been provided. I would rather have 21 ex-referees or even, it makes sense if it's ex-referees making the decision in a room, innit?
You could have 20 because then the referee on the pitch will be the 21.
The deciding factor, yeah?
Yeah. So like it's... Again, we are going to talk about this later on with the boxing. It's not as if FIFA don't have the budget to sort this out. I completely refuse to believe that. You can't have someone just watching the game live at home and then just using an app to do it, like just use your Twitter app or something. Do you know some equivalent to that? This isn't hard. It almost seems as if these controversies benefit the powers that be, because otherwise they'd eradicate them. They've got the resources. They've got the know-how. What is that? Why do these things still exist? And this is when you start having mad conversations about conspiracies and that. But you're getting to the point now where what's the actual reason other than crookery or conspiracy for entertainment's sake? I don't, you know, it makes no other sense otherwise.
Got from the FA.com, their rules about handballs. It's an offence if a player deliberately touches the ball with their hand or arm. For example, moving their hand or arm towards the ball. So it didn't look deliberate, but it's also an offence if the player touches the ball with the hand or arm when it has made their body unnaturally bigger. A player is considered to have made their body unnaturally bigger when the position of their hand or arm is not a consequence of or justifiable by the player's body movement for that specific situation.
Oh, lovely bit of wiggle room there.
Lovely bit of vaguity, man. You know what I mean? Nothing black and white. Like, what's the point in having that terminology if you're still going to leave it up to the discretion of the referee, which is essentially what it is, isn't it? And Jim's going to, like, you know, go through the decisions that have been made in boxing. You know, he probably will talk historically as well, but, you know, Josh Taylor being the most recent one. And sort of like, you know, how much weight is left on the decisions of people that are involved, and there's no clarity, and the rules don't offer any clarity, and it's the same in these scenarios. Do you know what I mean? There is nothing there. For me, I would say that he has tried to control the ball with his arm. Like, I would 100%, but then somebody else might say that, nah, he hasn't deliberately tried to do that. So what have we got that terminology in there for then?
But even if he hasn't deliberately tried to handball, quote unquote handball, he has made his body bigger by that movement. He's flicked out his arm. Maybe he was trying to get away from it, but he has actually expanded his surface area by moving his arm in that manner. And then the ball hit him on the bicep. So now who's to say that's either if that's a natural consequence of his movement or not, that's where the fuckery kicks in. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, watching it back, it did look like he kind of stopped himself from running, and it seemed very natural for your arms to, when you're running at speed. When you stop dead, it kind of seems natural that his arms would come forward that way. So it might be within the rules, that call, you know.
The contradictory rules, yeah, it's within those. Yeah,
the very grey rules.
yeah. The absolutely fucking pointless rules, yeah. I understand. But yeah, at least we've got the actual ruling now. We're not like talking in circles and people can hear the absolute fucking doublespeak Orwell levels that the fucking FA goes through to justify their shitty decisions.
Here's one for you. What would you say the rule should be? What would be the most black and white rule you could think of for this situation that would cover all bases?
Well, you just have to say if it hits any part of your sort of like shoulder downwards, no matter in what situation, which is what they had last year, I believe. They had in the lead up to any goal, if it touches your hand in, you know, at any point in lead up to goal, whether it's intentional or unintentional, that's it. It's a free kick. The goal doesn't stand. But then they've changed it and brought in this whole like deliberate intention thing, which obviously casts like, you know, doubts over and expands the ability or expands the capacity for referees to have their own opinion on it, which completely complicates the matter. I do think that we need referees talking to, you know, the fourth officials. And I think we need to hear that as fans. Like they do in rugby, do you know what I mean? So you can hear what the referees describe it, because you need to let the fans know what's going on. It's not good enough to say they're checking a handball and then check over, no penalty. That's not good enough. The fans need to hear the thought process of the referee to really understand the decision. So I think that's something that they need to start implementing in football as they have in other sports.
So you say it would be a good rule if anytime the ball hits a player's arm or hand from the shoulder down, free kicks given or penalties given. What's to stop me abusing that rule and kicking my ball directly at a player's arm in the hopes of getting a penalty?
Yeah, no, I think that if you do update and modify rules, and you'll find this in the NFL, usually, you know, players adapt and, you know, they change tactics and they try and exploit those rules. I mean, I don't think there's any, you know, there's no way really to completely eradicate controversy when it comes to refereeing decisions. I don't think you ever will do that in football. And we spoke about the random element of football and, you know, how there's never, ever one play that's ever going to be the same. I think that's what makes it so difficult for referees. I would 100%, I think that then there needs to be, I feel like there needs to be more help for referees in making the decisions. So I think rather than changing the rules on field, the way the decision-making process needs, the way the decision-making process is made needs to be changed. I think that's probably more important than actually changing the physical rules on the field. So I think there needs to be maybe two refs on the field, maybe one in each half. I don't know how much is that going to help, but hopefully they can be on the scene a bit quicker and they can have a good, you know, real perspective of what's going on. Because sometimes watching a slow-mo replay, that doesn't really tell you the story. If you know, watching it live and watching it happen in that moment and being close to the action, I think you have a completely different opinion to watching something in slow-mo. So it could have its good, it could have its advantages and disadvantages, but I feel like you'd get a more natural response from the referee for doing it that way.
Do we think that would be perfect? Do we think there could ever be a perfect rule system within football or any sport for that matter?
Listen, you can minimize the amount of controversy and the amount of gray area, but you can't eradicate it. The human movement in actual space and time is going to throw up randomness in it. So that's always going to be a factor. But even if, like you said, if it's just a straight, if the ball hits your arm, that's a handball, and the opposite team's players start aiming for those kind of shots. Listen, teams are trying to win. That is the adaptation. And if you're fucking good enough to smack it off someone's elbow from like 20 yards, then fuck it, you deserve the penalty, innit? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that'd be like a new technique, innit? There'd be a player that's very, very good at smacking the ball off the defender's arm and gaining a penalty. And that might be the new way of diving. Do you know what I mean? That's the new gamesmanship. So you never know. Like it's going to evolve, man. Like the way players play. I think baseball's the one. Like that's probably the easiest way to, you know, sort of get decisions correct for umpires. They're standing behind the plate. They have like a mental box in their head of where the strike zone is. Why baseball haven't moved on to just having like a digital box? So they know on the screen that they can literally have it. So, all right, that's a strike. They don't need an umpire. The only reason they've got an umpire is because they want, you know, to keep it baseball and keep it traditional and like have someone behind the plate that's going strike. Like that's the only reason I can think of, because like if I wanted baseball to be the fairest it possibly could, which is a sport I think can get the closest to perfect in terms of making decisions. Like you just have like the strike zone box, right? If it's out, then it's a ball. Like if it hits a strike zone, it's a strike. Simple as. You just have a digital strike zone. That's it. Easy enough. Like in technology nowadays, I can't believe that they haven't got that. So with football, nah, the random element will always make it difficult for referees to make sort of like a perfect decision. We'll move on to the five things you might have missed then. There was a very touching moment, and I'm sorry I made Jim a bit sad with this one, I reckon. Probably Flynn as well. Involving the Ukrainian forward Roman Yaremchuk. And he came off the bench to a rapturous applause from the Benfica fans and was handed the captain's armband as well. And the clip that you can find retweeted on our Twitter page shows him struggling to hold back the tears, man. And I was thinking, this is what football's all about. This is the only reason politics and football should get intertwined with each other is when there's situations like this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, great show of solidarity from the Benfica fans. And it did. I was literally just about to close my eyes and go to sleep. And that came through. And I was like, fucking hell, man. That's bare emotional. You could see from when he came on, he didn't quite understand the level of the reception he was getting because it kept on building and kept on building. And more people kept standing up. And then the camera angle from his perspective, it was kind of like over his shoulder. And you could see how close he was to the fans. And everyone was like looking at him, like cheering him on, showing him like, we're with you and your countrymen. Proper emotional, man. I did get a bit teary, but then I went to sleep.
That sort of moment being captured on camera as well. It cut to his teammate as well. And his teammate was like, I don't think he could believe it either, like the reception he was getting. So I think that made it like a really good moment as well. So yeah, definitely go and check that one out if you can. And number two, I was sat in a bar, as you do on a Sunday evening. And what sport? This is up Flynn Street, this is. They had a sport on TV, World Axe Throwing. And they actually have a full-on league with spring regionals, fall regionals, a Canadian Open, and a championship to cap off the year. Like, and this just made me realize that Americans will literally make a sport out of anything.
How was it to watch? Was it good?
It was fairly interesting. To be fair, when they were hitting bullseyes, I was like, fucking hell, that's actually pretty sick, man. And I think that they had like different techniques as well, man. That like some of them were sort of like pulling it back up really far and then sort of like slow and like golf swings in it. So I was pretty impressed by it. I wouldn't say like I'd ever watch it, and I can't imagine it has that many fans. There wasn't a single non-white person in the crowd. Let's put it that way.
No, I don't believe it, man.
I think it was in Texas. Like, I'm pretty sure like the majority of axe throwers are probably from red states, but I don't know, man. You never know. There could be a few Democrat states that have a you know, professional axe throwers.
I'd like to have a go, but my shoulder's fucked from darts, man. I don't know how I'd get on with like tomahawks. Do you know what I mean? It's a lot more weight in it. So yeah, this is random as fuck. This reminds me of something that came up on, I think it was YouTube today, that Arnold Schwarzenegger and Logan Paul are starting a slapping league. You know, when it's like arm wrestling, but they hold the thing and then they slap the fuck out of each other. So what is going on? People will do anything, won't they? Arnie as well, he always gets a mention. Good lad.
I think the Russians are usually pretty good at that as well. So hopefully they're not like fucking on the front lines, man.
Yeah, they're banned, the Russians. They're not allowed to compete until next year.
the heads of the slapping tournaments are fierce, man. You break the rules out.
Slap you up, mate.
And number three, New York City FC have signed yet another MLS youngest player in history. They've signed a 14-year-old midfielder, Maximo Carrizo, as a homegrown player, the club announced Monday. And the previous record was held by Real Salt Lake, who, you know, I think made it into our top five a few months ago, Axel K. And he was 14 years and 15 days old, while Carrizo has signed upon turning 14. The Manhattan native of Argentinian heritage is NYCFC's 10th homegrown signing since her academy was formed in 2015. Do you think this is a bit of a case of, like, we just want to sign youngest players and, like, not really give them the proper development avenues and just for the sake of it and just so it can be a news headline or what?
I mean, this doesn't tend to go well, does it, when big announcements go out like this? And the kids tend to play a lot of football when they're young, get burnt out, end up at Leeds, you know, under Bielsa, crock to fuck. But remember, the famous example is Freddie Adu, isn't it? The next fucking Pele, average player, according to Bissett, by the way. And he's just like, he had this massive reputation. He was on like Xbox game covers and he was on posters and he had loads of endorsements. And it was just this massive, like, it seemed like a lot of pressure for a young man to deal with. And I'm sure he's still knocking around somewhere in like Portuguese second division. I'm sure he's younger than us still. You know, I heard about him when we were still at Bishop. So for these type of publicity stunts, if they give him the proper developmental time and don't emphasize that he's the youngest signing, then it could go all right. But I don't like all this song and dance, man. They're kids. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem to me the most sensible way to move forward.
Yeah, you're right. Bar Axel K or Kai, he's the third youngest. Freddie Adu was signed in 2004, 14 years, 168 days. But interestingly, I was looking at the 10 youngest players signed in MLS of all time, and Freddie Adu is the only one that isn't sort of that is pre 2017. The rest of those nine players have come since then. So I think that shows a change of tact in terms of like promoting young players potentially. Or, you know, if you're going to look at it negatively, it could be a case of trying to produce them a little bit too early and, you know, the hype train being a bit too built up. But there isn't many players on that list that have, you know, really been successful. There's Gianluca Busio, who came through at Sporting KC. I do believe that he's now playing in Europe. I think it might be in Italy now. You've got some names that really haven't really heard of. Emmanuel Ochoa, San Jose Earthquakes. Don't think he's played much football. And there's another couple of players from NYCFC. Joe Scally, most notably, I think. I do believe that he's playing somewhere decent, I think.
Great name, by the way.
Isn't it? Scallywag. Where is he? Oh, yeah, he's currently at Borussia Mönchengladbach, so he's playing in Germany. I think, you know, this is kind of the problem with a lot of players as well, is, you know, they get their debuts in America and the MLS, and more often than not, the best players or the players that are showing the most potential will just go to Germany. They'll go to Italy. Do you know what I mean? They'll go, you know, not even sort of like to the big clubs in those countries. They'll go to like mid-table teams because they feel like there's more opportunity and more, you know, chance for a progression for growth. I think Caden Clark being a prime example, he was at New York Red Bulls and he's been signed by, he's sort of like, I guess that you'd call it the parent club, Red Bull Leipzig, or it might be Salzburg, one or two. And he's come back on loan to the Red Bull. So it's kind of like, all right, they're the kind of feeder club for those sort of teams, which is unfortunate, really, because I think if MLS wants to really change its image, they need to try and get that sorted.
Did you say these kids play for the first team, these 14-year-olds?
Some of them have.
Or are they in some sort of under...
Yeah, I mean, Freddie Adu...
Really? That's allowed.
Freddie Adu turned out. He turned out for DC United when he was 14. Some of them have signed these pro contracts and like not gone on to play any appearances for the first team yet. And they're now like 16, 17. But yes, some of them actually turned out and played appearances. I think Gabriel Slalina, I think for Chicago Fire, I think he's racked up about 50 appearances. And he's still like 17, I think 16, 17. So, you know, some of them got some good experience under the belt already. Some of them were just signed and potentially maybe they didn't kick on, or they were just signed as sort of like a pro contract just to sort of like boost the reputation of the club and their academy system. So it's really, really hard to say.
Do you think this ties into when we were talking to Nick a good few episodes ago about his experience coming up with a major club and then getting dropped at a certain age? Do you think this sort of story would tie into that? Do you see any sort of exploitation going on here?
Potentially. They might be. They might use it as a fact that, you know, with the academy systems in the MLS, you've got two separate sort of avenue paths for players, because they can go to college and they can go, play at college for 3 years, Division III, Division II, Division I. If you're a Division I player, you might get the opportunity to go into the MLS draft, which I don't think will exist for much longer, personally. And then you might get drafted into one of the MLS clubs. Whereas if you're good, if you're really, really good, you're going to be in the academies from a young age like these lads are, and you're going to get your opportunities early. Potentially, they're using these first, young pro contracts to try and tie them down for at least 2 or 3 years. Potentially so they can get a resale value for them when they're 16, 17. So, you know, clubs have to pay a transfer fee for them, because if they haven't signed a pro contract, I think prior to the age of 16, a club won't necessarily have to pay a transfer fee for them. So if a team from Europe wants to come in and nick your best player who's 15 years old and could be the next Freddie Adu, then they could just like sort of lure him away. Do you know what I mean? And he could, you know, turn out to be a really good player, just joins their academy system, and you've sort of wasted all that, I don't know, 8 years of them building it up. So it's a problem that I think, you know, clubs in Europe have to deal with as well. But I think MLS like players potentially are more prone to being poached from places like Italy and Germany.
Yeah, so for number four, a bittersweet one, and this article from CBS Sports graced my feed, I think it was first thing this morning, and it stated that former UFC heavyweight champion Cain Velasquez is facing an attempted murder charge. Velasquez was arrested in San Jose, California on Monday night after allegedly shooting someone, the San Jose Police Department confirmed in a statement. According to the San Jose Mercury News, Velasquez opened fire on a vehicle that was carrying a man who was recently charged with molesting a close relative of the former champion. The person hit by the bullets was the stepfather of the accused and is expected to survive his injuries, according to police. Velasquez is being held without bail at the Santa Clara County Jail and set for arraignment on Wednesday. The motive and circumstances surrounding the incident are still under investigation at this time, end quote. Now, obviously, the facts are still up in the air at this moment, but if this is true, Cain Velasquez is 100 times the Don I thought he was already. What an absolute G. And I'm telling you now, your man was smirking in his mugshot. He knows he did the right thing. All right, we're making omelets. A few eggs got cracked, but come on. Come on. He's a man of justice, isn't he? Fucking love it.
I know you'd be buzzing for this vigilante, like, pedo hunting or whatever it is. Obviously, we don't know exactly what's happened, but I knew that you'd be gassed for this.
Oh, Liz, have a look at his mugshot. He's wearing a definite smirk. He knows he's tried to do the right thing. I know he might have opened fire probably across a playground or something like that just to get at his man. But, you know, you've got to take drastic measures in drastic situations. I thought, honestly, this brought a smile to my face, and I hope he gets let off.
Interested to see the way he's targeted the stepfather of the guy that apparently has molested.
I think they were both in the car.
Okay, all right. That makes sense then.
So, and he's just like fucking strapped up, like ready to fire. Do you know what I mean? Maybe his time in the WWE brought something a little bit theatrical out of him. You don't know, do you? Because they're all fucking nutters over there. They were in the 90s anyway, back in the 1998 Hell in a Cell days.
Oh, those are the days, Flynn, ain't it?
The official Bull Chat number one greatest sport moment in history.
Yeah. After the two votes. I do actually need to check those because we said we were going to... I should have put some sort of disclaimer, like there has to be at least 20 entries for it to be considered like legit.
We have 20 listeners. Don't worry about it. Two is enough.
All right, number five. And finally, deliberations continue regarding Major League Baseball's collective bargaining agreement as owners and the players fail to agree on terms with only weeks to go before the new season. So I want to get company man's view on this. The MLB lockout has already taken its first scalp of games by delaying the start of the season, which is due to commence later this month. Both sides have failed to agree on terms concerning player minimum salaries, anti-tanking measures, and expanded playoffs, but to name a few. Basically, lads, this is a case of players being not happy that wealthy owners are not willing to share their piece of the pie, which has grown dramatically over the last decade. But unless I'm mistaken, players' wages have actually decreased over the past couple of years. Some of the top earners in the MLB are on eye-watering amounts of money, but at the lower end of the pay scale, which certainly includes the much larger percentile, players are earning lower than 700K. Oh, woe is me. But still, do you know what I mean? In terms of professional sports, that is relatively low for a huge proportion of those players. Obviously, to us, sounds like, you know, a lot of money. But I think the argument is that comparative wealth growth from the owners by their investment in the product, you know, is it, you know, essentially the players are the product in the MLB, and it which works a lot of the way in the sort of the system, different sort of monetary systems of different sports. And it really, they're seeing it as not being fair. So obviously a lot of information. This has been something that's been, you know, it's been talked about on ESPN, all the news sources over here for the last month. And it's sort of like culminated. It hasn't culminated yet, but the first signs of the season being potentially cancelled, it started to creep through. They've cancelled the first set of games. And I think for people that are like big fans of the sport, it's starting to get a bit worrying for them that they might not actually see any baseball like at all, at least for a few, you know, for a month.
Look, I think it's about time someone stood up for the 1%, because you see everyone shitting on them all the time. You see everyone shitting on the 1% as the people in charge, but a CEO, they get paid so much because if they make the wrong decision, hundreds, if not thousands, people lose their jobs. So, and before I give the rest of my opinion, could you tell me what anti-tanking measures are?
Yeah, so this is basically teams that are deliberately losing to get high-profile draft picks. So the way I would imagine this works is the same as other sports, apart from basketball. So it's basically like the worst team in the MLB, so those that don't make the playoffs, will be ranked in terms of their terribleness. So like if a team's like, you know, over 162 games, they've only won like 50 of them, for example, you'll be the worst team in baseball. So you'll get the best pick of the college players coming through. So it works the same way in the NFL. What I think the players want to suggest is that I think it works in the same way as basketball. You basically join a lottery. So the teams that are the worst teams in basketball or baseball, for example, they would enter the sort of lottery. And if you're the worst, you would get the highest percentage of chance. So you'd get, I don't know, say 50 lottery tickets if you were the worst team in baseball. If you were the sort of the best of the worst, so the team that just narrowly missed out on the playoffs, you would have a very small percent chance. So you would have potentially 5 lottery tickets instead of 50. So they want to have a system like that. So it would de-incentivize teams deliberately losing so that they can get a very, very good draft pick and get essentially the best player coming out of college.
So who's arguing for that? Because I can see owners and players are bargaining and they can't agree on the anti-tanking measures. Is it the players are arguing for more strict anti-tanking measures?
Yeah, yeah. They're arguing that, you know, they don't want teams to just deliberately lose just for the sake of it. Because I suppose that would negatively impact players, wouldn't it? If you're part of an organization that wants to deliberately lose so that they can get, I don't know, the next best pitcher coming out of college, then that reflects negatively on you. It's sort of like a defamation of your character, really, isn't it? Because if you're in a team that's deliberately trying to lose and you've been told by the organization that you don't mind losing, then that's going to make your sort of sell-on value go down. So I can understand where they're coming from in that regard.
That's a good point, definitely. Yeah, that's hampering the rest of their career development. I don't know where I sit on this one. It sounds like some of these owners are definitely acting in like an exploitative way. But this argument doesn't seem that unlike any other argument I've heard from anyone in any job in history. Moaning about the people at the top making the most of the money. It's just sort of how it works.
I'm glad you brought up that point. And I'll sort of revoice the counter argument to that I heard on the radio. So I'm not going to take it as my own because that'd be a bit uncouth. But they were saying that baseball's unique, as it probably is in other sports, is that the employers of, you know, essentially the players are the employees of the owners. And it, so the owners employ the players, they give them a contract. But the difference is in sports is that they are both the product and the employee. So, for example, if you're working for Amazon, right, the product is whatever it is that the customer is buying from Amazon. And so it could be, I don't know, say a computer. As an Amazon employee, you are boxing the product and then sending it out to the consumer. Whereas in baseball, the reason that you have consumers is because you have players. So they are the product. So people are buying in to this product. And if they're not there, then they don't have a product. So it's not the same as any other scenario, really. So I think there is a certain case for them to say that, look, you wouldn't have a fucking product if it weren't for the players, and it. So pay them their fair share. I think that's essentially what they want. Anthony Rizzo, who's he won the World Series with the Cubs, he came out and said that, look, I know we're going to piss the fans off, like, and we're sorry for the current fans, but the future baseball players down the line, we're doing this for you. So I think it is. And obviously a lot of these players want a lot of money, but I do think that, you know, they should be earning their fair share. And, it, you know, the capitalist country, you know, obviously there's two sides to that coin, but, you know, if they're earning sort of like, if their earnings have gone up 10 billion over a 10-year period and like they haven't raised the wages, like everyone's going to, you know, we'd be pissed off if that happened in our industries, in our jobs. Do you know what I mean? So I can fully understand why they're having this argument.
I'm all for player power. Always. You're absolutely right. Without the players, there's no product. Without the fans, there's no income. They've got the power. But the fact is, like, the cunts at the top are always going to take as much as they can. And I feel like, good on the players with the marquee names and reputations for saying we're part of this movement as well. So now, I doubt they'll agree to, like, siphon off a bit of their own income to make that happen. But they shouldn't have to anyway. Do you know what I mean? They should go on strike. They should fucking go on strike and see what happens, man. See how much money the billionaire owners have got when their main source of income's gone out the fucking window, man. Empty stadiums, people screwing. They should do that, man. Like the fucking, what's it called? What, the tube workers over here at the minute? You should absolutely exercise your power as the majority to do that. Look, we've said it time and time again, man. when you're an elite athlete, a sports person, you give up your fucking childhood, man. But you're not your evenings, you're not chilling with people, you're not partying, you're fucking dodging nonces on the way to the shower, waiting for Cain Velasquez to come and sort them out. Come on, man. It's ridiculous, man. And you get to the top and you want 700 bags and fucking some Warren Buffett lookalike is laughing all the way to the bank. It's ridiculous, man. Come on, go on strike.
And that leads us on to the feature fights. What? And I thought you were doing that deliberately, man. I was like fucking getting absolutely buzzing at the segue there.
I did not do that on purpose. I was actually going to say, I need a piss. I saw you doing those dance moves. I didn't realize I was onto a segue one. And I'm kind of sorry I let that energy burn down, but I'm sure.
Could have been the best segue of all time. That could have been.
But yeah, so you just this section off then. I'll
get to sleep if we do that, man. I need to get this out. I was so scared that the indignation that I felt on Sunday watching this fight would kind of simmer down and calm before the episode. Not at all, man. Every time I listen to a podcast about it, every time I read something, every time I see the highlights, I just think that was disgraceful. So let's get to it, man. Our featured fight section, the retrospective for this week. And let's just start by saying that referees Ian John Lewis and Victor Laughlin brought their pistols and bandanas to the Hydro last Saturday night, man. They're wanted, dead or alive, for robbing Jack Catterall on live TV. Absolutely disgusting. This is one of the most egregious decisions in a world title fight I can remember. And you can't move for shit decisions in boxing. So that is saying something, man. Josh Taylor, the undisputed light welterweight champion, the home fighter on the night, was soundly beaten by Catterall, who, up to that point, had been nowhere near the caliber of fighters that Taylor had consistently beaten on course to becoming the best 140-pound fighter on the planet. I'm a massive, massive Josh Taylor fan, but he got absolutely schooled. Then the man that beat him was cheated out of his victory. This one has left a really bad taste, especially when you consider that Catterall had been out of the ring for 18 months and was considering going back to work. He was so skint. He took step-aside money as the mandatory challenger, allowing Josh Taylor to unify the division against Jose Ramirez last May. Then after all that time waiting, he walked into the biggest fight of his life against one of the best fighters on the planet, boxed the head off him, knocked him down in the eighth, and still saw Taylor's hand raised at the end. What the absolute fuck? I didn't even watch it live. When Pizzy and the lads told me the result, I was actually more excited to watch it because I couldn't foresee a circumstance where Catterall would school Taylor. And then when I watched the fight, I was absolutely flabbergasted, man. The decision has been widely condemned, though I have seen a few on Twitter shrugging it off. Now, Steve Bunce's article for The Independent begins by urging for calm and balance, but turns into a prolonged case against the possibility of corruption existing in boxing. Like, he's having a fucking laugh, isn't he? Carl Frampton said the same thing in one of his post-fight interviews. Even Howard Foster, the only judge on the night who scored it for Catterall by 113 to 112. That was way too close for me. I said the same thing when Taylor beat Ramirez. That was 114, 112 across the board in a fight he absolutely walked. He scored two knockdowns in that fight as well. But the right man won, so those disgusting cards were swept under the carpet. And at least Taylor walked away with his titles. What does Catterall have now? A high ranking. He'll get to fight for the vacant WBO belt when Taylor moves up for probably a third of the purse he could have got the other night. Fucking wicked, man. The board have announced they'll be investigating the scorecards. To what end, I couldn't say. The damage is already done. They're going to be investigating themselves. So I can't imagine the results are going to be too damning. Even if pride compels Taylor to do the rematch, I don't think Catterall will ever catch him slipping like that again. I'm sure of it, man.
All right, Jim.
Travesty. Robbed.
I want to play devil's advocate a little bit. I'm gonna go on Flynn levels of provocateurism, if that's a word.
Yeah, go for it.
But and this is a point of view that wasn't brought up by many. I saw, and I'm going to use the Twitterverse as a sort of measuring stick for these things, as I do quite often. A lot of ex-fighters and people involved with the game that know much more than I, they were talking, in terms of like, look, I love both fighters. I know both of them very well, but there's no way that Taylor won that fight. And I think that was the sort of general consensus, probably about 80 to 90% of people. There was a few And I think Carl Froch was the one that stuck out in my mind. And he was saying, Chip probably hates the geezer anyway. He was saying that you can't go into a championship fight and for the last four rounds be in defense mode and be in survival mode and expect to walk away with the title. I do think that that's slim pickings. I think that is him trying to be a little bit pedantic. What do you think?
He's back on the floor ride, isn't he? Carl Froch, I'm telling you. He's, listen, I don't hate Carl Froch. He's one of my favorite fighters of all time. His resume is beyond reproach. He's talking out of his arse. It doesn't say in the rules what direction you have to be traveling if you're winning a fight. I think I gave Taylor two of the last four, and there was a point deduction in the 10th and the 11th for each fighter, so that evens itself out. I also gave Taylor the 12th round. I think he did finish quite strong, but I think I gave Taylor three rounds overall. Catterall gets the knockdown in the 8th. I literally don't see a scenario where you can give the fight to Taylor. Even if you give two or three more rounds to Taylor, which I would say would be really, really generous. Really generous. And I don't actually think you should, with like a calm mind, give him those rounds. It'd still be a Catterall fight to me.
But once
it'd still be a Catterall fight.
It's nonsense. Like, the way it's scored and the way the judges are conducting their review of the fight, it's not optimal at all. They're not using data. They're not using figures. They're not using, you know, landed punches, percentage of landed punches. They're not using, you know, how many power punches did they land? How are they scoring it? And that's the objective nature of it is going to lead to things like this happening. And I'm not saying in any scenario that it should have happened. And I think that the general consensus is that the wrong man won the fight in this scenario. But how many times have we seen it in the past? And we're just going to continue to have this conversation every time. Like, Canelo Triple G fight is another one that sticks out in my mind. And the judge, the female judge on that case, that was like 116 to 110 or something in terms of Alvarez, in terms of Canelo.
You know what's interesting about that one? A longtime advocate of Triple G in that fight, Joe Cattell, shout out if you're listening. He's been adamant since that fight happened that Golovkin scored Canelo behind the jab. And I went into his house and we watched it together and we scored it together. And he was like, yeah, I could probably see a draw or a point either way. And I had it a point to Canelo. So that just shows you that in retrospect, or you go back and a replay, it could give you different results. I'm not trying to say that if I watch the fight tomorrow, that I wouldn't score a few rounds differently. Absolutely not. The second was very close. The 5th and the 6th were kind of close for me. These are, you know, being as generous as possible to Taylor. I'm not saying Catterall, someone summed it up perfectly. There were close rounds, but they were cleanly won by Catterall, just on bigger punches. Like, a lot of Taylor's work was a lot more scrappy based on aggression, et cetera, et cetera, and just work rate. Whereas Catterall was far more composed, landed the more deliberate shots, the more hurtful shots, was controlling what was going on. Just because he's not moving forward doesn't mean he's not in control. Fucking Floyd Mayweather. Do you know what I mean? He was his best when he was on his back foot. I don't know. The amount of fucking doublethink that's been going on and the insistence that there's no corruption in boxing. Come on. What the fuck are we talking about, man?
Just to go back to a point you were making a minute ago about how you were scoring these fights. How are boxing matches scored? Is it aggression? Is it punches landed? What's the official criteria? Or is there one?
There's four criteria for most world championship fights. And because it was in England, the British Boxing Border Control would have jurisdiction, but it's also a four belt unification fight. So they would have to have some sort of unified agreed rules. Now, I've got my little green book somewhere from the British Boxing Border Control, but that's probably outdated by like 5 or 6 years now. I'm sure we could go onto the website now and look. But basically, it's like clean punches landed in scoring areas, basically between the waist and the top of the head. Arms don't really count. You can't punch on the back. Effective aggression. What are you doing? Now, a lot of people interpret that to mean you're going forward and you're being really aggressive. But for what if you're stepping back and walking lads onto uppercuts all night long? That is effective aggression. Ring generalship. How vague could you be? What the fuck does that mean? Ring generalship. Obviously, that means who is dictating the tempo, the pace, the direction of the fight, who's controlling where the exchanges take place. But fucking, you know, have more detailed criteria than that. And there's another one that I'm forgetting. But basically, I would be happy to sit down with anyone with any kind of scoring criteria, and I'd be open to listening to them about how you could score that fight for Josh Taylor, because I'm aghast. I'm incensed by it, man. I don't see it. And it's not that I don't want to see it. I would like, if someone could educate me on why I'm wrong, I would be happy to accept that information and assimilate that into my future viewpoints. But at the minute, I don't see it, man. And it just stinks. It's slack on Catterall, man.
Sounds like fucking nonsense. Yeah, we haven't even got into that. We haven't even got into that. He's been fighting, you know, scrapping for his whole life. And what you were saying about him, you know, thinking about, you know, potentially getting a normal job and, like, you know, moving out of the fighting game. And that guy should be the undisputed champion of the world.
He'll never get that chance again. He'll never get that chance again.
Because, you know, it's disgusting. It really is.
Honestly speaking, yeah, I don't think Catterall could beat all the fighters that Josh Taylor beat. I don't think he'd beat Regis Progre. I think the version of Victor Postol that Taylor beat, I think he'd give Jack Catterall a lot of problems. Maybe not Ramirez. But, you know, this is... Josh Taylor's a fucking modern day great. I'm not slagging Josh Taylor. It just happened that Jack Catterall on the night was composed enough and he had the game plan and he had the attributes to beat Josh Taylor, that version of Josh Taylor. And that's it. It's as simple as that, man. I'm not cussing Josh Taylor at all. I hope he goes up to 147. I still think he'd give Terence Crawford a good fight, but this is fucking robbery, man. Absolutely harsh.
And a couple of, scenarios to throw at you. Like, why can't, and I've said this before in the past, I've spoke about judges making the decision after watching a replay of the whole fight. But let's say even half an hour where they collate evidence, where they have data presented to them by people that are not judges. So this is the judges. So the judges are presented with certain information after they've watched the fight and they've got their own opinions about how the fight went. They've got their own opinions about levels of aggression, where the fight was fought, you know, in the ring and who was the person on the front foot. Any of that they want to, you know, collate into their own sort of opinions on who won the fight. But then they also have, I don't know, a rerun of certain rounds, even watching a highlight reel of the fight. Surely that would give them like a more well-rounded perspective and get them a better chance of getting this right. Obviously, the counter argument to that would be that, you know, in the conspiracy theorist's mind, that they were paid off. But let's say that didn't happen and especially two of the judges got this very, very wrong. You know, is there any way? I feel like there's loads of ways that boxing could do a better job of making sure that we don't see this happen again.
All three of them got it wrong. It just so happened that Howard Foster had it by a round, like the right way, but that's still not acceptable. That's still not acceptable, you know. And as to your point about having that half an hour delay to watch replays, it's similar to what we were talking about with the football earlier. There's TV to consider. You know, you can't have people sitting around for half an hour, people in the stadium, or, you know, it's just not, the scorecards the other night took a while to be read out and it weren't like any more than 5 minutes. And it still felt like a really long time, even watching it on a replay the next day, knowing the result. So I'm not quite sure, but even things like punch, that's just a guy or three or four guys on the night just watching the fight and just clicking when they see a punch landing. But that is so up for grabs, even when you're watching it on live TV with the best camera angles with replays, there's still things you're going to miss. There's still, when the fights are that fast and the fighters have that many skills and that many attributes and they're playing tricks on each other and they're luring each other into traps, there's so much going on that I don't think it's like possible in real time to get the best result judged on the night. And, you know, you don't want to announce a decision then fix it the next day, do you? It kind of like take the air out of everything. So I don't know what the best way is forward, but fucking hell, they need to change something. They need to change something because this keeps happening, man.
Yeah, and we mentioned, you know, would the BBBFC be able to reverse a decision? I'm not sure if they have the power to actually do that or whether they can order a rematch. Can they do either of those things?
In order to get the rematch on, you'd have to say to Josh Taylor, look, we're going to strip you, but he's moving up to 147 anyway. He's unified the division. He's made one defense of his undisputed championship. You can't have him on the hook. He's moving up. So there's bigger fights for more money against, you know, better renowned fighters than Jack Catterall. So, you know, I don't think they can really do anything. I think the most likely scenario is the titles get vacated and Catterall fights for a vacant against someone probably equally as dangerous as he is. And he might not even win that fight. It's fucked.
There's... What have you got to say about the allegations made by the Fight Disciples podcast? They've alleged that an Irish mob boss, Daniel Kinahan, represents both of these fighters, and they believe he may have had some part to play in this. What do you make of that?
What, do you mean an Irish gangster living in an asylum in Dubai did something dodgy? Nah, I can't see it, mate, myself. Can't see it. Now, honestly, I don't see the upside in that, because if Catterall wins, you're more likely to have the rematch, aren't you? And then it's like another big payday. You could do it in Manchester, right next to Chorley, isn't it, where Catterall's from. You could just make it a bigger thing, like Frotch Groves. They had that bad stoppage in the first fight. They made it into the biggest super middleweight fight in history. They took it to Wembley, like 80,000 fans. So I don't know. I don't see the upside in that, really, unless it's like to get Josh Taylor away to welterweight on a win. But I don't know. That... Even for me, that's a bit conspiratorial, like, to be honest. But I will listen to the episode if that's what they were saying.
All right, should we move on to the boxing on Sunday night? Obviously, Lawrence Coley was here, was involved, and also our own Gilal Yafai. So let's have a quick roundup of that.
Yeah, quick one, man. Coley defends his WBO cruiserweight title against Mikhail Cieslak, who had half a Warsaw with him in O2 Arena. So fair play to him. Cagey affair. I wouldn't recommend it as a rewatch, but for Coley, when the guy doesn't want to fight, it's hard to land punches, and he was still managing to land punches, even if it was a bit of a boring affair. So fair play to him. He's definitely showed improvements under Shane McGuigan, the coach that Josh Taylor has just left for Ben Davison, incidentally. As you said, Gilal Yafai made his professional debut on the undercard in a 10-rounder against Carlos Vado Batista, who's 10-4-1. This kid, game as you like. Now, he wasn't in there to lose at all, and Yafai, very aggressive. We've seen him in the Olympics. Southpaw, walking opponents down, doesn't really jab that much. He just looks for hooks and uppercuts up the middle. He does a very good job of mixing up his speed of punches and his range of combinations. He did actually get hit quite a lot with some heavy shots, man, in this fight. It's his professional debut. There's obviously a long way to go for his development, but he needs to tighten some things up, because down in those weight divisions, like 115, 112, there are some fucking killers, man. You'll get some Nicaraguan lad who's had like 70 fights and you've never heard of him, and it'll clean your clock quick time. So he needs to sort that out. Other than that, I was actually really impressed with him. He's definitely got the appetite to punish his opponents. He's definitely got the punch variety. And I think, yeah, if they just tighten up a few things, he could definitely go all the way. He's got a good matchmaker behind him. He'll get the red carpet treatment all the way to a title. And an honourable mention to Jordan Gill, who pulled out the stoppage of the night and possibly the year so far to claim the European featherweight title against Kareem Gwerthy. Gill was down in the seventh and reportedly had both eardrums ruptured. By the time he did the old Del Boy Chisora trick and stood in the corner, weathering a heavy storm before pulling out a beautiful short right hand to render Gwerthy unconscious on the mat. Gill couldn't even stand up straight to celebrate. What a lad, what a victory. But there's definite limitations there at featherweight. Similar story to what Galal's got ahead of him. There are some fucking serious fighters down at featherweight. Great win for him. European Championship stepping stone. I think he should stay at that level for a little bit before he steps up to face the big boys. And Islam Makhachev, UFC Fight Night main event. He squashed Bobby Green in the first round. No surprises there. That was fucking ruthless, man. He just dragged him to the ground and beat the shit out of him, proper Khabib style. Which leads us to the look ahead for next week. UFC 272, Colby Covington versus Jorge Masvidal. Former teammates turned enemies, allegedly. Both twice beaten by the 170-pound champ, Kamaru Usman. This is the next best fight to make. Do you guys have any thoughts on this one?
Like we said when this was first announced, they did over our Brummy boy Edwards for this. So I can't back this fight in any way, shape or form. Though I still want Masvidal to get knocked out.
That's a fucking joke. Yeah. The good thing about this is I don't think they're fighting for a number one contender spot. I think Leon's going to get the next shot regardless. So, I mean, unless if Gilbert Burns and our boy Khamzat happens and Khamzat absolutely smashes him, then I could see Khamzat getting that shot against Leon, because they don't seem to like him over at the UFC, do they? They don't seem to want to give him props at all. So I was watching the build-up to this, the embedded and the other fucking build-up show the UFC does in the endless promotion of fights. And I just got the feeling this was just one big fucking farce. You know, I don't think they're really enemies at all. I think this has been a long game. I think this has been promotional masterpiece from both of them. So, but still, it can make for a really good fight. You know, I think Jorge Masvidal has got the more fluid striking. And I think Colby Covington has got the more slick transitions into a wrestling-based affair. But they're both like second best in the division. So that's what they're fighting for at the minute. I still think it'd be good, man. I still think it'd be an entertaining fight. And as for the boxing this weekend, there's a cracker scheduled for the little fellas. Roman Chocolatito Gonzalez versus Julio Cesar Martinez. No belts on the line as Martinez is moving up to Superfly, with Gonzalez losing his title to one Francisco Estrada via split decision last year. This is guile, experience and skill in Gonzalez against an alley cat of a fighter in Martinez. Very much looking forward to that one. And I would favour Martinez in the upset.
And as a closing comment, Jim, I wanted to get your opinion on some recent news, I think, in the last couple of days that Tyson Fury has came out and surprised quite a lot of people by announcing, I'm not sure how true this will turn out to be, that he's set to retire following his fight with Dillian White in April. What do you make of this? Is this mind games? Is this like he's being deadly serious and this is going to be his last fight? Because he's still only, what, 30, 31 years old. He's sort of claiming that, all right, he's got money in the bank. Like, he doesn't need to fight anymore, which is a good point. But what do you make of this? You know, where is he coming from?
Well, I think if you could ascertain where Tyson Fury is coming from, you'd be a fucking millionaire yourself. You don't know where, you don't know what the man's on, dear. But I would say that even though in terms of numbers, he hasn't had a serious, like a ridiculous amount of fights for a heavyweight, I would say there's a lot of miles on the clock, because you got to bear in mind that he had that 3-year layoff, ballooned up in weight. Even before that, he was having layoffs of like 15 months here, 12 months there, 16 months here. And, you know, his lifestyle, the amount of punishment he's taken in those Deontay Wilder fights, you got to take that into consideration. He had a very unexpectedly tough scrap against Otto Wallin from Sweden, where his eye was fucking hanging off like Vitaly Klitschko style. He was lucky that fight didn't get stopped, to be honest. And just the grind of boxing and being in the limelight, you know, he wears it quite well. He seems to relish it, but that's got to be quite taxing after a bit, you know. And on the flip side of that, I think it's basically a fuck you to AJ. Like, he was talking the other day about how they were going to give him step-aside money so Fury and Usyk could make the unification fight happen. And they agreed terms. They were going to give Dillian White $5 million and AJ $15 million. This is according to Fury, obviously, so a dash of salt on top of this. And then at the 11th hour, AJ came back and said, no, I want $5 million more. I want $2.5 million out of your purse, and I want $2.5 million out of Usyk's purse. And Fury was like, fuck you, man, it's not happening. He's like, you're just being a greedy bastard now. I was going to give you more than you're worth anyway. So AJ seems to have negotiated himself out of potentially fighting the winner, because that's what was going to happen. Dillian White would have got shafted. AJ would have got the winner, and that's that. But now you don't know what's going to happen with Usyk. He's over in fucking Ukraine, strapping up with Lomachenko and the boys, isn't it? So you don't know what's going to happen there. And yeah, this AJ Fury fight is just doomed, isn't it? And I think Fury's just, more than anything else, I think he's trying to make that point. Like, if you keep fucking around, I am going to retire. And this fight would have passed us all by. So that's where I think he's coming from.
And what do you think, you know, could a potential scenario exist where Dillian White ends up like becoming the unified champion, heavyweight champion? If like Tyson Fury retires, Usyk, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, he's not allowed to fight, or he's not able to fight. And then it's just Joshua. Like, can you imagine some weird scenario where that happens?
That would be the least likely scenario, I suppose. It says something that you're banking on one of your champions to die in warfare just so this man can become champion. But yeah, even if it was just him and AJ, last man standing, I think Dillian White is definitely the weakest of those four. I think you wouldn't give him a prayer against Usyk. You wouldn't fancy him against AJ. And, you know, I think
I don't think I fancy Fury against Usyk, man. I think he probably doesn't want that fight either.
Ooh, hot take.
I think that's a hot take. Pele, average player, Baker by trade. And to be fair to you, Bishop, Usyk's a problem for anyone. And if you doubt his intelligence and you doubt his mobility and you doubt his will to win a fight, you're bang in trouble, man. If Fury turned up to that fight half-cocked thinking, I'm the bigger man, I'm going to fuck him up, he would lose that fight. But I don't think he would show up to that fight like that. I think Usyk's a fucking problem.
I think he's too intelligent for that as well. I think Tyson, you know, he gives this bravado and, you know, this, I'm just going to smash him, this and that. But I think he's quite a well-calculated, intelligent fighter as well, to be fair.
Yeah, definitely, man. And it's just this thing with AJ and Usyk, like that's up in the air now. And you don't know what's going to, I don't know, boxing's a fucking mess at the minute.
Yeah, really is. Well, I think that's all we've got time for. That's all she wrote. Once again, pleasure, lads.
Cheers.
Nice one, boys.